never said we should plan this and we should think about what we need. And we were talking about a lot of things around that. And one of the things that I kept hitting on was awkwardness. And I have to confess that I am an extremely awkward person. It's scientific. I went to a neurologist 30 years ago. I've been having a lot of problems with my sinuses, and they were concerned. And they were going to do sinus surgery, but before they did that, they said, we really need to do a brain scan. And so I went into the neurologist, and they put all those little things all over your head, and they did this whole experiment and and a test. And I remember afterwards, the neurologist said, please come into my office. And I sat down, and he says, I have some very serious news for you. So I'm thinking, I've got a tumor, I'm going to die. You know, it's like, this is the most horrible thing. Like, oh my gosh. And I'm already planning. And he says, you're just really extremely unable to be, to walk well, to, like, you're clumsy. You're really clumsy. You're really awkward. And it's because of this brain damage that's right here in this part of the brain. And so you probably have a lot of trouble. And he says, and there's just nothing that can be done about it. And I said, you know, I didn't have to pay $800 to find out that I'm awkward and clumsy. And like, my mother could tell you that when I was like three, you know, like, like, it's not a big deal. Like, I just didn't get it. And so I was a little irritated with having to spend that much money to, you know, please, I didn't have a tumor or something. So, but the awkwardness is just a real deal. And my whole life I've been awkward. And my most awkward moment, because everybody has those really horribly awkward moments in their life when you just wish you were like on another planet or had never been born or whatever. So I'm a newlywed, right? Now, when you're a newlywed, you come home from work and you're a guy, and my lovely wife is standing at the kitchen stove cooking dinner for me, and I'm thinking, this is awesome. You know, I like being married. We've been married a couple weeks. So I go up behind her and I grab her and I start kissing on her, and I'm saying, you know, this is great. And of course, one thing kind of leads to another, and so she turns off the stove and she says, before we go do anything, you stink. Why don't you go take a shower? You've been at work all day. You smell. Would you just go take a shower? So I did. I ran in, took a shower, quick shower, and came running back down the hall, stark naked, into the living room where my sister-in-law was sitting, visiting with my wife. My sister-in-law, who I couldn't look in her face for years after that, right? Like, this is the most awful moment. Like, you just want to die. That's a story I've never done. So much shame, so much awkwardness, so much uncomfortability. Like, what do you do, right? What, we just live in this awkward world. We just live in this world where we do silly, crazy, awkward stuff. I liked this. Just because you can't, gotta love Dilbert. Do you mind if I pretend to be helpful while I awkwardly try to upsell you? Nope. Do you mind if I pretend to be listening while I think about other things? Cool. I'm glad I don't have your job. How old is your refrigerator? Do you like ice? That's kind of our nature, right? We're always in these sort of awkward situations, these awkward conversations, the awkward moments, and we just live in a really uncomfortable world. There are two kinds of awkwardness, and one of them we can't address. We can't, you know, that a newlywed comes running down a hall naked. I mean, that's just too much, right? By the way, you know what happens with that story is that years later, of course, my sister-in-law just has to bring it up every chance she gets to, you know, and tells the story on family occasions, and it's just, I mean, it becomes funny, right? And we can tell it, we can laugh, because in the end, it really wasn't that horrible. So there's the natural awkwardness caused by living in a broken world. We just live in a broken world. There's just awkward things. You know, I'm 6 feet 8 inches tall. I bang my head on a door. It's just the way life is. I don't know why they created doors 6 feet 8 inches. That's just stupid. They could have made them 6 feet 9 inches. But some carpenter decided, that's as far as I can reach, and then they standardized it, right? So I'm bumping my head. I just live awkwardly in an awkward world. There's brain damage. I can't help that. I was born this way, you know? Like, there's nothing I can do about it. And that's awkward. It's uncomfortable. There are times I'm going to be getting on a plane Monday morning. I'm going to fly to Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'm going to be miserable for several hours. I am probably one of the few human beings that you know who has flown literally thousands and thousands and thousands of miles who's never used a restroom on an airplane. Because, you know, I don't fit, okay? So I make sure I go before I get on the plane and I come racing off the plane, right, you know, and I hate a four-hour trip. Now, I'm worried because we're supposed to go to Puerto Rico sometime next year, and so I don't know what I'm going to do, but, you know, not drink any fluids. Yeah, it depends, yes. natural awkwardness, right? So we're just awkward. We just live awkwardly. There's just stuff we run into, things that are, there's stuff that's true about us that we just can't do anything about. It's not our fault. Then there's the sinful awkwardness by us that's caused by us wanting to present a false image. Not who we really are, not who God created us to be, but we try to present an image that we're not. We try to be something we're not, somebody we're not. We try to project this image. By the way, his reputation is expanding faster than the universe. He once had an awkward moment, just to see how it feels. He lives vicariously through himself. He is the most interesting man in the world. I'm sure you've all seen the Dos Equis commercial, right? This is the Dos Equis guy. He is the coolest guy in the world. We like to think that cool people are not awkward. We like to think that rich people aren't awkward. We like to think that beautiful people aren't awkward. Everybody is awkward. Everybody. We're all awkward. We're just awkward at different times, in different settings, in different places, in different ways. Everyone is awkward. We're always awkward with each other. I remember when I first moved to Tucson, there was a guy that had planted a church up in the foothills, and he had invited me to share office space with him. And so we were talking, and I said, you know, it's probably, you know, I assume that all the people in the foothills kind of have their act together because they're wealthy, they're living up there in the mansions, and they drive really nice cars, and they're comfortable in their life, so that, they have social skills, they have all the things that they need to survive in that environment and to do well. And so I was kind of saying, you know, it must be nice to pastor in that setting because you don't have people with issues. And he goes, are you kidding me? He said, the highest suicide rate in Tucson is in the foothills, just so you know. People are really uncomfortable up there. They're always two paychecks like everyone else on the planet. They're two paychecks away from disaster. It's just that their disaster is on a much higher mountain than our disasters, right? We're all beautiful people, smart people, rich people have all the same issues. We like to think that that's not true. And most of us who are either, you know, average looking or have issues with our looks or we think we're, you know, way poorer or we don't have the stuff, we automatically make assumptions about people that are simply not true. The most interesting man in the world once had an awkward moment, okay? So now he claims he just did it to see how it feels, but at least he's had an awkward moment. So that's the most interesting guy in the world, and he had an awkward moment. So all of the rest of us are going to have awkward moments. We live in an awkward world. We're awkward people, and we're going to have awkward moments. That's just how it is. So the best we can do is do awkwardness in community. It says, don't worry, I'll be awkward with you, okay? And so we're just kind of standing around, and we're in community, and we're being awkward together, right? That's what we do in community. One of the passages you always hear talked about at the Village, one of the things that's just always been true about us is the verse, Eric preaches at every wedding, we talk about it all the time. I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. That's Adam's response when God comes looking for him. God says, he's walking in the garden, he's assuming Adam and Eve are going to come and walk with him. Well, he's not assuming it because he knows what they did, but he's looking for them, and when he finds them, they've sewn together fig leaves, and they're hiding from him. And when God says, what's the deal? Adam says, I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. And God's response is, who told you you were naked? And then he's like, oh, you know, God knows. So, and in this setting, we like to think, well, that's just, they were nude, right? They were without clothes, kind of like me running down the hall. And that they were just nude. But that just is such a limiting thing. They were naked, and naked really means completely vulnerable, right? Vulnerable to being judged, vulnerable to being judged by others. I mean, Adam could have looked at Eve and said, you know, you're kind of letting it go, kid. You know, you need, you know, you're not exercising, you're not, you know, and she could say to him, you know, you're not naming animals like you used to. You're not as creative as you used to be, and you need to work on that, right? None of that happened. They were just vulnerable to each other. They were just open to each other, and they were open to God. Everything was an open book. Now, we can't imagine living in that kind of society, right? We can't imagine living now in the light of that reality. We're like, really? I mean, one of the things that they do, if you want to learn how to speak, do public speaking, is they say, well, imagine everybody in the room is naked. You know? No, you know, I don't want that picture in my head, right? But that's kind of one of the ways that you start laughing, and then you relax, and then you're comfortable speaking. So we couldn't imagine living that vulnerably with each other. We would hate it. It would be disgusting. So we want to hide. Our nature is to hide. We want to hide who we are. We want to hide what we do. We want to hide how we think. We want to hide all the time. There's two things that you should know. One is, you can't protect yourself from awkwardness and embarrassment. No matter how carefully you live, you're going to be in awkward moments, and you're going to be embarrassed. It's going to happen. You're going to have that moment when you're running down the hall. You're going to have that moment when you think, you know, like the day my wife thought, I'll just run. None of the neighbors are out looking. I'll just run in my nightgown and go get the newspaper. She runs out to get the newspaper. The door slams. It locks. Now she's out there. She's pounding. The neighbors are all coming out to find out what the pounding is about. She's pounding on the window trying to wake up Derek or me or somebody to come and open the door. So she's out there in her nightgown. All the neighbors are coming over because they're concerned because they hear it. Suddenly she's humiliated and embarrassed, right? You can't protect yourself from that. It's going to happen. Get over it. Okay, just get over it. Stop worrying all the time about what's going to happen or how you're going to look or what, you know. We sit there, you know, when we get so wrapped up in trying to protect ourselves from awkwardness, we live very small lives. If you want to live life fully, you're going to have to understand that there's just going to be awkward moments. The second thing is, you can't protect yourselves from others, from awkwardness and from embarrassment. A lot of times, we want to protect those we love. Particularly, this is true between spouses and in families. We want to protect our family, but it's also true in friendships. We want to protect people from embarrassment, humiliation, awkwardness. We can't do it. It's not in our power. It's interesting in Scripture that whenever you read about shame, You read about God protecting us from shame, which is really cool. His people from shame. And, like if you read through the Psalms, the shame is always wished on the enemies, that they would be brought to shame, that the things that they're trying to do wouldn't work, that they'd be humiliated and embarrassed. So shame is never about, God never shames us. He doesn't embarrass us. He doesn't humiliate us. That's because we live in a broken world and we are broken. We live, and this has changed dramatically in my lifetime. So some of you will simply not, I'm going to tell you like stories about the olden days and you're all going to fall asleep, but that's okay. You know what? When I was growing up, visual image was not what it is at all, like it is today. We didn't judge people based on how they looked. Today, if you want to be president of the United States, you have to look good. You have to be well manicured. You have to wear this perfect tie or the right dress, or you have to have your hair done perfectly. You have to look good. Abraham Lincoln would not get elected president today. You know, no, we're not, in our culture, in our North American culture, we want perfect people. We want people with image. We live in the age of image. We constantly judge people based on image, and we're constantly judged by image, right? So what we project, what we look like, what we talk like, it's constantly being judged. And so we live in that kind of an environment, and it's easy to get trapped. When I was a kid, that wasn't as true. Now, we had other hang-ups, right? I mean, we judged each other on other things, like how hard you worked, that kind of stuff. But we didn't measure looks and success in the way that it's measured today. And I think it's really sad, because we live in a world where we're constantly feeling that judgment. We're trying to measure up to what people want of us, expect of us. Coolness, the coolness factor is so important. We want a certain thing, and then I'll be cool if I get this certain thing, or if I wear the certain clothes, or if I look this certain way, or if I get my hair cut a certain way. It's funny how I grow my hair out regularly, and as it gets longer and longer, and then I get it cut off and give it away to Locks of Love. But every time my hair is short, people think I'm Joe Businessman, and they think I'm smart and capable and a good leader when I go back to the denominational stuff. And the longer my hair gets, the shaggier it gets, then they start thinking I'm either some weird counterculture guy or a hippie or a guy who should grow up. I'm constantly judged just on my appearance. Cops stop me when my hair is long. They never stop me when my hair is short, ever. The longer my hair gets, the more likely it is that a cop's going to stop me for no apparent reason. Not because, I mean, I do speed, don't get me wrong, but okay, and I do some other bad stuff. But still, I shouldn't get stopped as often as I get stopped. And every time I do get stopped, it's not when my hair is short. It's when it's long. Why? Because people make judgments. They're constantly judging us. That constant judgment is hard to live with. We just automatically have our little moments where we think, and it's not like we can just get up and walk away from that. We live in that culture. That is our culture. We have television program shows constantly consumed with image. News shows, and then saying the right thing, and it has to be worded just perfectly carefully. So we have all kinds of people in trouble for things they said or things that they blurted out in a moment of frustration, and now that it's suddenly their whole life's work is being erased because they have something that they said that was wrong, or something that they did that was wrong, some social faux pas that they can't recover from. And we experience that. I don't know. Tell me some of your experiences with being judged or judging or you got any stories? Yeah. That's exactly how it feels, yeah? Very nice. Nice. I did wear a leisure suit with white shoes and white belt and a pink, bright pink silk shirt, just so you know. I probably have pictures somewhere. No. No. Make that a firm no. So we like to think that there's one image, right? But what you really do is you create the counter image, right? So you shave your head and say, you know, and now you have this, well, that's a rebellious thing, and now you're wearing that as an identity, and as a, you know, that, and that becomes its own culture, right? We create cultures that way by doing something that. Right, there's assumptions. Sure. One of my favorite moments was when roofers came to roof my neighbor's house, and they were up there on the roof singing opera. Just great, like, so, right? Because we have these assumptions. We make these assumptions about people, and we shouldn't, right? We should do exactly that. Let me, things to ask yourself in awkward situations and settings. What image am I trying to project or protect? Whenever you're in those awkward moments like that, you have to start thinking, now, what image am I trying to project here? What image would I like for people? How would I like to think people think of me? And, or what image have I already projected that I now have to protect? Because heaven knows if they really knew. When I would go back to home missions meetings for the Christian Reformed denomination, and I would go back to Grand Rapids, and I would come into the room, and there's a lot of people there that grew up in very traditional Christian Reformed churches. And so when I come in dressed the way I'm dressed and shaggy-haired, and there's an image there, and they're saying, well, Rod, we need you on this board because you're counterculture. You're different. You come from Tucson and you do this whole different church thing, and so we need to hear your voice. So that becomes my image, right? And now I want to protect that image. I don't like that image. I'm the counterculture guy. Yeah, I'm cool. You know, that's cool. I like being counterculture. So I want to protect that image. And so I do things that enhance that image, right? I do things that make that image come even more alive because I like that image. I like how that feels. Or maybe I come to Grand Rapids and I go into those meetings and I want to try to fit in. I want to try to be a traditional Christian Reformed guy. So I put on a tie and a white shirt and maybe wear a suit. And I don't actually hardly, I think I own a suit, but I'm not sure I would fit in it. So what image do I want to either project or protect? That's a great question to ask yourself when you're in those moments of awkwardness. What am I trying to project? What am I trying to protect? Any comments about that? Go ahead.
I went to high school in Virginia, and the East Coast is a very narrow culture. You either conform or you look down upon really easily. So I moved out to Arizona, and I become part of the West Coast mentality. But then I went back to my 20th anniversary, and I thought, oh, I better buy a shirt and a tie and wear my jacket. And I showed up, and then I'm sort of browsing around, and I can blend in. I can be like these people again. And then this guy shows up, hey, Jeff, I'm Jeff. And I'm like, I recognize this guy, and he's like a guy from my high school. And he's wearing this Hawaiian shirt, no tie. He lives in Hawaii. He showed up at the East Coast, 20th anniversary.
Nice.
In his Hawaiian shirt and shorts. And I'm like, why didn't I have the bravery to be who I am?
To be who you are.
You know, I was afraid I wouldn't fit in. Just like I was in high school again.
Right.
And other places in the scripture where it says,
I think it's important to recognize that God doesn't protect us from discomfort or awkwardness. He doesn't say you're never going to be awkward or you're never going to be uncomfortable. We are going to be uncomfortable. We are going to be awkward. We live in a world where it's broken by sin. He's going to allow us to do that. Another thing that I think you should ask yourself in awkward situations and settings is, do I believe the gospel, right? Do I believe the gospel? Do I really believe that the gospel is true? Do I believe that Jesus loves me and cares for me in this moment, in this really awkward setting? Do I believe that he's pursuing me, that he wants what's best for me, that he cares for me? Is that true? A third thing is, do I trust that God is my protector? And this goes, I think, to what you were saying as well, Tricia, which is, does God protect me in these uncomfortable situations or in these places where I now travel or avoid traveling to? Or in the places, you know, at my high school reunion, is God there with me? Is he protecting me? Is he protecting my reputation? Is he protecting, who I am, my identity, my real identity, not the one that I put on? But do I trust that God is my protector? And then also, in that moment, do I trust God with those he puts in my path, right? There are those who, if you're in an awkward conversation, God put that person there for a reason. You're not accidentally talking to this person. It's not just, I got stuck at the restaurant and there's that person I didn't ever want to see again because they saw me running naked down a hall. And now we're sitting across the table from each other, and I wish I was somewhere else. Does God put us together for a reason, right? He wants us engaged with those around us. He's not putting us into uncomfortable situations that he knows are uncomfortable just to torment us or make us upset. No, he's doing it because he has a purpose. God doesn't accidentally bring people into your purview and into your life. He does it very purposefully, even if you don't understand the purpose or the outcomes of those purposes. Any comments? Oh, sorry. Right, and if I did it to myself, is it so that God is teaching me to be more wise the next time, right? Right, exactly. When we go back to this image, what image am I trying to project or protect, right? So in your habits, in the things that you do habitually, what image are you trying to project? Eric talks a lot about in their house, they had to clean like company was coming, right? I always loved that because that's how my mom was, and that's how it is in our house now. So you have the junk room where you throw all the stuff and you close the door and you, no one ever goes in there, right? Hopefully somebody wandering down the hall to find the bathroom doesn't open the wrong door because then everything falls in, right? Because you throw everything on there. You vacuum, you do a quick dust, you clean the counters, you throw the dishes in the dishwasher, and it looks like this is how you normally live, right? But it's not how you normally live. You know, Kathy and I have constant arguments about this, right? I said, why are we trying to project an image? And she says, well, you know, you should care, and I should, but I don't. And so, and then seeing I'm in charge of cleaning, then she's upset with me because I didn't clean. And so we have these huge arguments about this, or just like our habit is, you know, I don't like for people to just walk in and see how I normally live. What am I trying to protect? What image am I trying to protect? So think about your habits. Think about those things that you habitually do. If you hear somebody's coming over, what do you do and why? What now, some of it, there's, and here's my wife's side, there's a godly side to this too, right? Because it's hospitable to have a clean house, and it's nice when people are coming over to have a clean house. So that's just a good hospitable thing to do too. So it's not like these are 100% evil, you know, you clean your house and you don't normally live like that. No, that's being hospitable. When people come over, you want them to be comfortable. Part of them being comfortable is they're in a clean house. So, you know, I'm just saying, and it can be. I'm not saying this has to be yours. I'm just saying for my habits, right? I'm not, so I don't know that you can disagree with my habits. Right.
Because it puts shame on the person visiting knowing what their house is like. I can't ever have you over.
And that's why I'm saying when we analyze our habits, we're analyzing why we do what we do. So what's my motivation for doing it? Well, it's to appear a certain way and then to protect that image, right? And if it's not true, then what I'm doing is sending that false signal that you can never come to my house because, you know, this is how my house looks. So what are those habits in your life? What are the habits that you have that you do? Like, analyze those things in light of, am I trying to project an image that isn't true, or am I trying to protect an image that I've already projected and don't want people to find out the bitter truth that my house is always a mess? Same thing as with my job, you know. I remember when I wanted to impress somebody a long time ago, they asked me what I did, and I said, I am the chief financial officer of the largest automotive parts wholesale distributor in the southwestern United States. The independent, and it was true in those days. Now, granted, there were only like 3 independent warehouses left in the Southwest, but I was one of them, you know, and I was the chief financial officer, and granted, it wasn't that big of a company, but it sounds really good, right? And people are going, whoa, I'm impressed. This guy's really smart. Well, I might have been smart, but I was trying to project an image of smartness that was well beyond what I actually did, right, as chief financial officer. Now, some of you are saying, just being chief financial officer, you know, well, I'm a glorified accountant, right? And if I want to downplay my job, I might do that. I'm just an accountant, really, you know, bookkeeper. Because we prioritize those words, right? We have them in our head, and we start thinking one's really good, and one's really not so good, and one's really, you know. So we do that. And so what in your job are you trying to either project or protect in the way you describe what you do and how you do it? If you're a student, if you're, you know, how you work, where you work, what work you do, what image are you trying to project? What image are you trying to protect? Body image, right? I'm 6'8", 334 pounds as of this morning. It's irritating to be fat. You know, I don't like it. And so I like to make excuses for it. I like to talk, if I want to protect an image that it's really not my fault at all, then I talk about how I had a really serious intestinal disease when I was 30, and I almost died from it, and because of that, it's attacked the ability of my body to absorb certain foods in certain ways, so I can't eat a lot of the really healthy things like spinach and grainy breads and all the stuff that you're supposed to eat, because it really causes me a lot of pain when I do that, so I can make this wonderful excuse. Or I can say, yeah, I'm just fat because I'm a slob and I just don't care about anything, and I like to cook and I like to eat and it's too bad. Or I can project some other image, right? Whatever image about the fact that I'm 6'8", 330, whatever it was, 4 pounds, it says something about me, right? It says that there's part of that image that I can't deal with at all because I was born 6'8". I can't get my legs cut off. I remember my older sister, Miriam, is 6'4", and when she was in high school, she would walk around like this because she was trying to look, you know, shorter, which made her look taller, of course, right? Because we're so, and I can remember my dad saying, put your shoulders back, put your chin out, stand up straight, because then you look, you know, you're not going to look so tall as when you slouch. And he was right, and of course, Miriam had body issues for a lot of years because of that, you know, sudden recognition that, you know, you're a 6'4" woman or a 6'8" man, you're just going to tower over people. There's nothing you can do about that. But there's also parts of our image that we want to protect. We want to, you know, when my hair gets long, I want to project a certain image or protect a certain image. If my, you know, depending on which way my weight's going, I want to project or protect a certain image. What about your body makes you uncomfortable? What about your body do you think everyone notices? What do you think? And then what do you do to try to hide it? Or just say, there's nothing I can do about it, so I'm just going to revel in it and pretend that it's the greatest thing ever, even though being tall is really great until Monday when I get on the airplane, right? Then it's no fun at all, right? Because I'm crammed into a seat, and the poor slob that has to sit next to me, and my legs are crammed up against the seat, and then the guy wants to put his seat back, and it's like, really, you know? and I want to kill him, and there's just nothing I can do about it, right? Except rage, and I can't even go to the bathroom and let off steam because, you know, I can't fit in those. So there's just this stuff about your, what is it about your body that you're trying to protect or protect? Your past, right? So many of us have issues with our past. We're concerned about, you know, if people would know my past or if they didn't know my past. Or we do the counterculture thing. Let me brag about my horrendous past, right? Used to get those wonderful deals about, yeah, I was addicted to 47 different kinds of drugs, and I was a drunk, and I was, you know, I beat my wife, and I did all these horrible things, but now I'm, you know, a whole new person. And so we kind of tout it as this, as a part of our good image, or our I have pulled myself up by my bootstraps image, or I'm really ashamed of it. I remember when Jimmy was going to start his church, and at some point we were talking, and he has all these shame issues around his being arrested for growing marijuana. Well, he got a felony conviction out of that, and so when he was trying to go to Canada, he got stopped at the border. He was going to go serve a church up in Canada, and they wouldn't let him. And so it was just humiliating and embarrassing. So he never wanted to tell his story. So when he came to the village, I said, Jimmy, you got to tell your story. So now he does this sermon where he goes and preaches it everywhere, his stand-in man story of the way that Jesus rescued him. So our image, you know, we can either shut it all down and be ashamed of it, or we can just project it. What image are you trying to project or protect with your family and your friends? So what is it that I want people to think about my family and the relationships in my house or with my parents or my children? What image are we trying to project? Talk to me a little bit about the images that you're trying to project a little, or just some of the stories around that, or just some of your pushbacks or thoughts or ideas on that. Go back to the things you should ask yourself. Do I believe the gospel? And I just want to run through these. The gospel is redemptive, and I think that's what Reuben was just saying, that God redeems the situations. The beauty of the gospel is that God, that is a redemptive gospel. It redeems the situation. So even when I'm pretty sure I screwed it up, God redeems it and makes it right. He makes it the way it's supposed to be. And so he is not, so when I believe the gospel, when I say, I'm in an awkward situation. I had to fire a dearly loved bookkeeper of a Christian school that I was the president of the board, and so I had to fire him because we had caught him embezzling huge amounts of money, right? Thousands of dollars. And then I had to go to the elders of his church and talk to them, and then they confronted him, and he wouldn't confess or acknowledge that he had done the evil for a long time. And then one day he called me on the phone and said, I don't want to meet you in person because it's too embarrassing and humiliating, but I really did steal that money. I'm so sorry, and I'll try to pay you back, although I never could. And it was an opportunity to forgive him and say, go and sin no more, and be gracious as I could to him. And then a couple years later, we were going to have a training for elders, just a guy who was teaching about how to be an elder and what it meant to be an elder. And so I was excited. I went to go there to just sit at the feet of this guy. He was a seminary professor that I admired, and I wanted to listen to him. And there were probably 40 or 50 people in the room, all of whom either were elders or had desired to be elders or had, you know, had been elders in churches. And so we're all gathered there, and here comes Lloyd into this meeting. And it's like, oh, this is awkward, right? This is a guy that I had all these intimate dealings with about him stealing money, and now he's at an elders training? You know, could I just be somewhere else, God? That would be really cool. And so when the break time came, the inevitable break time, I looked to see which aisle he was going down, and I went down the other aisle, right? So I wouldn't have to encounter him. And instead, he crossed over, which is not fair, right? So so I cross over to go to the first aisle, and then he crosses back over. And it's like, okay, and he keeps pointing at me, and then he comes walking towards me. And it's like, oh, this is going to be an awkward conversation. And I said, so how are you doing, Lloyd? And he said, Rod, I've never properly thanked you for confronting me when I stole all that money. And I know that must have been a horrible time for you. And I'm really sorry what I put you through and what I put the school through. But you don't know the rest of the story. The rest of the story is after I talked to the elders and after I eventually confessed to you and to them, he said, I was in a small group in our church, and these people just walked with me and blessed me and cared for me and helped provide for my family. And I've been making restitution to the school. I don't have a ton of money, but I do it as best I can, a little bit at a time. And I've never gotten to thank you for the beauty of what you did and in confronting me and bringing me to the table of decision, right, to this moment of where I have to either confess or be horribly miserable. And he said, so I just want to thank you, and if I could, I'd like to give you a hug. And so we hug awkwardly there in the middle of the room, and I'm crying, and he's crying, and he said, it's the beauty of God's redemption, right? He takes a really horrible thing, and somehow he makes it right. He said, you know, I know I'll never be an elder because I did this horrible thing, but I think I could be now because I understand redemption and I understand grace. And that's such a powerful story in my life, and he gave me permission to tell it anytime, anywhere. And at his funeral, I had the opportunity to go and share with the people there because he knew he was going to die. He asked me to tell the story. And he says, and don't pull any punches. Tell them the whole story. And so I've told that story over the years because the gospel is redemptive. It changes circumstances. So even in the most awkward of situations in our lives, God can redeem it, fix it, make it different, make it new, make that first meeting as awkward as can be, but yet still redeem the overall situation. Don't ever forget that. The gospel is absurd, right? We think the gospel is just this kind of normal thing. We normalize the gospel way too much. The gospel's absurd. It's crazy. It can fix any situation. It can change any life. It can do anything. And it never acts the same way twice in people's lives. We like to think that people come to Jesus because they come to church on a Sunday night or and hear a great sermon. That happens like once out of 4 million times, right? Normally it's because you just have these really weird, awkward, strange, goofy conversations somewhere in the middle of the day or over coffee or over a beer or whatever, and you're sitting there going, you say something and that triggers something, and then there's this whole conversation, and then all of a sudden this person is asking you what you believe about God, or you know, it's never the same. And we love to try to normalize things. And it's just absurd. It just doesn't work. If you listen to all of your stories of how you came to know God or how you came into a deep relationship with God, try to find a common thread. You won't, right? Because there's just these weird, unique, wonderful, goofy ways in which God brings the gospel to bear into our lives. And so whatever awkward conversation with you are in, you can trust that it's going to be crazy. It's going to be weird. It's going to be different. You know, Kelsey's story of coming to Christ is one of the most hilarious stories I've ever heard, right? I mean, she's like, I just love it. And I love the way, and that, this verse that matters to her is something about a mule that, like, don't be like the stubborn mule, right? Like, really, that's what led you to Christ, right? I mean, it's the goofiest story ever. Ask her about it. It's wonderful, right? Those kinds of stories are our stories, and they're mixed in. So if you have this way in which you're going to try to manipulate conversations or hold conversations with people or engage people because the gospel has to be presented a certain way, let it go. The gospel is absurd, and the gospel is relentless, okay? The gospel never stops. It's going to keep flowing into the situation time after time. When I met with Lloyd that first time, the gospel was there. When I met with Lloyd later, the gospel was there. When he called me and I was in my office and confessed, the gospel was there. The gospel was in that meeting. The gospel was there throughout his life. The gospel was there at his funeral. And the gospel's still going out of that story because I'm telling you about it tonight, right? Because the gospel's relentless. It never stops. Do you believe the gospel in your awkwardness, in your awkward settings, in your awkward conversations, in your awkward moments, in the awkwardness of relationship? Do you believe the gospel? And the gospel is good news. We forget that sometimes. We think it's just news. It's not. It's really good news. And so it's always redeeming, it's always changing, it's always making things better. The gospel doesn't make things worse, although it may appear so at the beginning. It's always good news. Do I trust that God is my protector? God provides my true identity. God provides my true identity. Whenever I hear Eric say that, or one of you all say that to me, there's some, sinful, evil, horrible, hideous part of me that says, yeah, right, whatever. Do you ever say that? Do you ever think that? Do you ever go like, yeah, I know, my real identity is I'm a priest and a child of the king and blah, blah, blah. We have like the Sunday school answer to it, and it becomes like a Sunday school answer. It's kind of like, the kids here say, yeah, we know what that means. Like, we take it so for granted that God provides our identity. But we have to hang on to that identity, and you never know it more than when your identity is attacked, when somebody's making fun of me for whatever, some awkwardness in my life, some awkward appearance, some awkward way of being. Whenever that happens, I have to run to that true identity of who God says I am. I'm not defined by my size. I'm not defined by my deep voice. I'm not defined by my job. I'm not defined by any of those things. I'm defined, my image comes from Jesus. My image is, as I grow more and more into him, I become more and more like him, and that's who God says I am. God provides my true identity. God protects me from my false identities and the ultimate shame that comes from living them out. God protects me from my false identities, the ultimate shame that comes from living those out. We think that if we protect our image in some area, that will lead people to love us, care about us, think about us, be mindful of us, listen to us, think us wise, think us brilliant, think us beautiful, think us great, think us whatever. But the truth is, your sinful identities will always out. You will always get exposed. You will always get caught. Sin will always rear its ugly head. It always will. So I can pretend that I'm, really smart and, try to look wise and, wear spectacles and put my diplomas all over my wall or whatever. And I can pretend that. But eventually, if they're all fake diplomas, and if I'm not really wise, it's going to get exposed. And then the shame is so great, right? The shame of being exposed is so great. And that also then becomes that moment where the gospel comes to us and says, but that's not who you are. Your identity is who I say you are. And that's what God does. So ultimately, all of our false identities, all of the images that we try to project or put out there are destined for failure. They're just not going to work. The more intimate your relationships, you know, unless you completely alienate yourself from any kind of relationship, right? You can, you young women can try to dress as amazingly, beautifully as you can and put on all the perfect makeup and make yourself look a certain way. But there are going to be times when you're in an intimate married relationship with a guy that you're going to step out of a shower and you're not going to have all that beautiful stuff and you're just going to look the way you look. And you can't pretend that that made-up image and that beautifully dressed image is who you always are, because we know better, right? And the same is true for you guys who are trying to project a certain image. It's, if it's a false one, if it's, if you're trying to pretend that you're somebody you're not, it's going to get exposed. Eventually, as your relationships grow more and more intimate, the exposure of those false identities becomes greater and greater. Do I trust God with those he puts in my path? God puts you and me in certain places at certain times for the sake of embodying the gospel. You are the gospel. You're the good news. We forget that sometimes. We think we're just people. No, we're the embodiment of the good news. We are the embodiment of the gospel. And you're always on. I love my Uncle Paul. He died a few years ago. He said, he would always tell me, Rod, you're always an example. You're always an example. Sometimes you're a good example. Most often you're a bad example, right? But moms can always point to you and say, either be like that guy or don't be like that guy, right? So you're always an example. And that's kind of how it is in this world. Our image, the image that Christ puts on us, is always being exposed, and how we live in that out of our sinfulness, how we live into the gospel, and how we live into being honest and people of integrity and present who we really are, we're always on. We're either being exposed, our false identities being exposed, or our real identity being called out. The church is the hardest and the safest place to live out your identity. Here in this place is where God's called us to be together. If you go home and you read the 16th chapter of Romans, the last chapter of Romans, the first part of it is just this beautiful, Paul is just greeting people. And I remember just skipping through that for a long time because I just thought, eh, it's kind of a goofy thing. I don't even know these people. Who cares? But one time I did this intensive study on who each of those people were, as much as you can find out about them. In that Roman church, you had Herod's grandson. Now, Herod is the one who's trying to kill people, right? Kill the Jews. So Herod's grandson is in the church in Rome. And so are Greek slaves. And so is some guy named Rufus and his mother, who's like a mom to Paul. So he's like the church, she's like the church mom, you know. There's slaves, there's servants, there's business people, there's a lady who sells purple cloth. There are people who have churches that meet in their homes. It's just this incredible group of weird, strange people that have no connection to each other than the gospel. And I think that's true in the village. There's nothing that brings us together except the gospel, the good news of what Jesus has done. So in some ways, it's the hardest place for us because we're constantly rubbing up against each other here. And I know that some of us are really worried that we bring our friends, that we kind of want to control who they talk to and control, you know, the situation. We hope, you know, Eric's preaching because, you know, he's cool, or Rod's preaching because he's cool, or not cool, but whatever he is. And you know, which band is playing what music, and gosh, I hope they don't play that one song because I hate that song, and that these people are, so we make up all this crap in our heads, right, about how people are going to be reacted to and how they're going to react. Let it go. This is the safest place, contrary to popular belief, to bring your friends to to missionally bring your friends to. This is as safe as it gets. It's not safer out there in the world somewhere. This is the safest place. Into our monastic communities, into relationship with each other, people we've grown to trust and know, people whose foibles we know. But to do that, guys, you have to tell your stories, and you have to tell the true story, right? You can't sugarcoat this, your story. You have to talk about your suffering, your pain, your struggles, your scary places. Because when you tell your story, people go, oh, well, I can tell my story too. This is a place where it's going to be okay, where people aren't going to laugh. They're not going to make fun of me. I kind of rushed through this last little part. If you have any questions, I'd love to. I don't think either one of those are that we can really know who we are, right? Because God places this identity on me. I can go to Scripture and say, this is what's true, right? But I can't say that I'm not going to believe that in the moment. And I think that's where we do cause each other pain and hurt, right? It's because we don't take hold of the truth of who we are, and we do hang on to an image because we're sinners. You know, we're not... We can't get it right. If the demand is we have to get it right, it ain't going to happen. This is a place where we're going. I love that we irritate each other, right? We're going to rub up against each other. It's what we do with the rubbing up of each against each other and the pain that we cause with our words and our actions that says more about us. And even that we're going to mess up. So, but it's still the safest place. I didn't say it was a safe place. It's the safest. And this goes to the heart of what it means to be in community together, because being in community together is ultimately about mutual submission, right? So that I allow other people to speak truth into my life, offer me, you know, and say, no, Rod, you're not Rod, no mercy, Hugin. You're Rod the Merciful, right? You cry and you weep. We see this in you. You're not, you don't have this identity that you think you have, right? And then I have to say, well, that's not true. I've always been, you know, Rod, no mercy, Hugin. I'm kind of proud of that. That's an identity I like. You know, it keeps people away. It makes me a tough guy. In karate, it was a great thing to be known as Rod, no mercy, Hugin. That was kind of a cool title. I wanted to, you know, put that on my gi and, you know, kind of make it a target. But it was so to project a certain image, I wanted that. To submit to the reality that people said, no, Rod, you're Rod the Merciful, you weep, that's hard, right? Because normally it's just jarring. So often the truth about our identity is the one that jars us, right? To say, really? That's who I am? Because that's not who I thought I was. And then we have to redefine and you know, and we do that. Now, you can't completely just give away your identity to what people think of you either, right? Because that's dangerous, we all know, because all of you are sinners too, despite your protestations. And so you don't necessarily know me perfectly either. But often it's those outside eyes that see us and can call that out, and then particularly in the church community that we submit one to another.